I'm Karen Hughes. I am 61 years old and I live in Berkeley, California. And I identify primarily as white from North European descent.
Hi, I'm Ian Conyers from Detroit, Michigan, 32 years old, and I identify as a Black male.
And we're hanging out on Sunday, January 10th, 2021. So nice to be chatting with you.
It's nice to be talking with you as well. Look forward to the conversation and continuing to learn more and have the conversation.
Yeah, me too. I have to admit, I feel kind of nervous about it, but I know it's good. I think it plugs into my gotta be perfect, but we're perfectly imperfect in this process.
I think that's exactly it in terms of taking the first steps into the uncomfortable zone is what folks like us have to do and should do to kind of get the ball rolling. I mean, if we can't do this in a safe space, it's like, how do we expect other people who have never met or don't know to be able to talk and find common ground?
Yeah, great. Well, can I ask you one of the first questions that we agreed on? Do you have a specific story about why and when you joined Reparation Generation?
I do. And thanks for the question. I think it's important for us all to know why we, as folks who didn't know each other, have come together to make this bold step. I was first made aware of Reparation Generation by Kiko Davis, who I have had a great relationship with in Detroit and philanthropy and also policy in general, and have grown the friendship over the years. And when it comes to reparations, I've been involved and known about it kind of on a more policy level and a family level. My uncle, the late John Conyers Jr., who served for over 50 years in Congress, was the author of the bill that's now known as H.R. 40. And having went to his hearings on the bill, and then when I moved to D.C. to go to undergraduate, getting more involved in what it actually meant, this group coming together, I raised my hand and said, I'd love to be involved and bring what I have to the table.
That is a great story. And I just, have to say, I heard of your uncle forever. He was the great man, one of the great men of Washington. So it's pretty cool to meet you. And I'm sorry he's not here to be part of it himself.
Appreciate that.
Well, I think my story is, I've been around a while and I feel like I've done many things in my personal life and how I try to live my life that are about equality and full humanity. But I have to say that the Black Lives Matter movement, especially when it kicked off more back in 2014, I felt like it stimulated my learning. Like I realized there was much I didn't really get. I got what I got and I didn't get what I didn't get. And so I felt like that started a growth in my own awareness. But then, of course, this past May, June, when George Floyd was killed. And honestly, probably that was one of the first recordings of a killing of an unarmed Black man that I watched, because I tend to have a lot of media skepticism, but I watched it and, I was deeply affected. And then with friends of mine at work, when we were debriefing, and in particular, I heard from my Black friends and coworkers, and I heard their challenge to me as one of their white friends to get out there and put my body on the line in a way that I hadn't. So I dug in and was learning more. And I was also simultaneous. I felt like I was realizing that in my own life that I was going to probably be the beneficiary and be part of the generation or the age group that was going to experience the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth. Mm. I'm not counting chickens too much before they're hatched, but the likelihood that I would gain a lot of money as my parents pass away, that I had nothing to do with earning, and that frankly, I love them and I respect them and they worked hard, but the timing of it for them, but as I now know, just so many of the underlying systemic policies, procedures, official, unofficial, that have played into their creating this wealth, coming from being farm kids in Minnesota and Wisconsin who met in San Francisco. So my awareness of this transfer of wealth, this massive amount of money across our country, combined with what could I do that is some version of putting myself out there, making more of a self-sacrifice. And so just really trying to figure out what I could do to contribute to some kind of sustainable, deep, long-lasting, meaningful change. And so the reparation generation, the idea that it would focus as a main focus, just literally moving money, transferring money, you know, while I know it's just one small strand of what overall reparations needs to be, it felt like it was something that I could really relate to and be an authentic voice for and shift money in my life to hopefully make a difference and get other people to do the same.
Thank you for that. And it just, you know, had me thinking briefly in terms of, you know, farm kids working hard and were able to save and make a difference. You know, your recognition of that really speaks volumes, because in many ways, it has to be that group stepping up to address what others couldn't simply pull themselves up because of how far down you were starting. My great-grandfather got to Detroit in 1920 up from Conyers, Georgia, which bears the name of the family that owned our family.
Wow.
I had the opportunity to put myself on the line in one way, go down there and knock doors for Stacey Abrams in 2018. And it was such a like cyclical, interesting, you know, like, this is my last name, this is where I'm from, to be back in Georgia. But, you know, he was able to come to Detroit in 1940 with a third grade education and save up, but never even come close to that opportunity to earn, to save, and pass it on. And in terms of the transfer of wealth, you know, I'm a millennial, and I think about, you know, when you first read about Black intergenerational wealth and you don't come from much, you think, oh, all of the kids who look like me, whose parents made something, are going to end up right back in poverty. And if you worked hard to get somewhere, you might not have too much of a concern about those who have had. Mm-hmm. But as you grow older, me personally, I've started to realize, even if I continue and become a top earner, the likelihood of my kids returning to poverty, no matter how hard I push, is something near 75%. And it's just such an unnatural experience to be able to not ever make it out generation after generation just through your hard work or your work product.
Oh my gosh. The other thing about like the farm kids from Minnesota and Wisconsin, one of the things when I learned, and I have had to really re-examine and re-understand one of my family's stories, which is my heroic grandparents who homesteaded in Minnesota, who came from Norway individually. And because there was no property for them, they had to, you know, get sponsored. They came here by themselves. They never saw their families again. And my grandmother in particular homesteaded the land. And so she worked for 5 years, she paid her $50. I'm like, she's been this hero. And now I'm like, that land is stolen. That was somebody's land and their livelihood. And so not only have to work on continuing to simultaneously love and appreciate what people did, but understand the bigger picture and the unfairness and the form of violence that that represents, and that that is part of the foundation of myself, not only in terms of dollars and cents, but just, you know, access to property and how that contributes to one's social norms and perceptions of being a leader in your community, or, you know, just the things that come with that, that are not kind of intangible, but are really there. So that, and then also having to rethink about the stories about the scary Indians, the drunken Indians that used to float by their homestead house out in the middle of nowhere. And that I was so scared that my mom would tell me those stories. So I'm having to sift through information and, you know, not cry about it, not spend too much time on my being angry about it. It's like, I'm just more about, okay, what to do about it? What can we realistically, meaningfully do?
It's really important. It's a foundational question of who we are. And both of those truths can exist. And it's when we talk about them, the truth, that it helps create the future that we want to live in. It's the only way to solve. It's the only way to reconcile. And I think so much of what we're doing is that work. You know, it just speaks to what a lot of our countrymen and women are going to have to do if we want to live up to what we've been promised.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you hearing my truth. That's the part that will make me cry. I mean, I think I know we've had conversations in Reparation Generation, at least especially in my more communications subcommittee, I think also with organizing. Like, I think it's clear what we want to make happen. And one of the questions is, how important is truth telling and speaking our truth and then knowing that our truths are heard as part of our reconciliation process? And I think it's really important. I don't always know the best way to get it done, but I do agree with Brian Stevenson has really emphasized, we have to tell the truth. It's not just about money exchange. At least I believe that too. So this was really nice even just sharing that story with you and having you hear it. Is there a story, you know, as a Black American that you want to share about something that was really difficult?
Yeah, one that I remember in every Black person in this country likely does is the first time on the field of play when the difference of your race with your childhood friends comes up, when that awareness happens, whether it's the first time you're called a racial slur and you're not sure how to respond because you haven't been socialized that way, or it's a feeling of knowing that you're being excluded. For me specifically, this is like sixth or seventh grade, went to move a friend's sister in with her boyfriend. We're there, moved her stuff into her boyfriend's place. One of our teammates, they're white. We're two young seventh grade Black football guys, and we're just helping. And then we sat there and waited for her to come back, where two of his friends had been sitting there with us watching the TV. We kind of looked around the apartment. We noticed some interesting flags on the wall. One of them I now realize was a AV Iron Cross. In the far left corner, it was a swastika.
Wow.
It's that moment when you realize you're sixth or seventh grade and you're in way of your head and you're away from home.
Yeah.
You were just trying to be helpful. Her boyfriend got back to the apartment first and looked in the apartment, looked at us on his couch, went back to his room, then came out about 2 minutes later. He's about 20, mid-20s. We are, you know, 13-year-olds. And he looks at us and says, and, you know, it's a bit strong. He says, why is there a nigger in my house?
Aye.
And more stunning than that, the first time somebody calling you that, was the response of his two friends when they look at him and they said, they're too young to be niggers.
Oh, wow.
And that always confused me so much. And I think the look on his face and one of their faces was, what are we doing here? Where we're believing in an ideology of oppression. He clenched his fists and said, get out of my house. Right. And so we both stand up almost as if to face total punishment, not a good situation, but had a choice to sit down and take it or to stand up.
Yeah.
And we both stood up, two 12, 13-year-olds to a mid-20-year-old. One of his two friends got in the middle of it. And I think he had that internal moment thinking, yeah, it's cool to talk that talk and sit around amongst our own group and put other people down and say, this is the reason for my problems. But when they saw it actualize what that violence looks like, to two teenage boys who just helped you move in.
Yeah.
It was something that always stuck with me. And I think what came of it really is an education piece. You know, we ended up, the boyfriend broke it up, we left, and it was just kind of a scarring moment. But I think when you go back to what you learn, there's three things that happen. You read in your books as a kid, almost like Martin Luther King died and all was absolved. All the things got better from there. And then you look at civil rights legislation, and to a certain extent, you look at legislation that has said, hey, you can't sexually harass women anymore. You can't do this anymore. We've legislated that away. It's no longer a thing that happens. And so when you believe, when these moments happen in your real life, the first things that happens is that you're confused. And then the second thing that happens when you realize what you believed in is not true, you were so gullible to think that the laws were going to protect you. The second thing that happens is you're humiliated. And you feel confused, humiliated. And then the last stage is that you're angry. And I think that if we can, you know, now see ourselves in a moment where we're not going to hide behind what the policy says and what's actually happening, this is what has to happen. And so, you know, that was a moment that stayed with me for the rest of my life. And I don't want other folks, although they are continuing to have this next generation, have to experience that. But thank you for hearing my truth.
Oh, I'm so sorry that happened. And an aspect that's clicking for me is like, who set you up for that exactly? You know, obliviously or not considering that could happen, and or taking steps to ensure that it didn't, if you were going to help them out. And it's related to sort of what you've said is like, oh, but the rules say that's not supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think this is related to white privilege. Like, it's not like the rules always were followed in my life as well. The spoken rules, you know, you bring up sexism, you know, that's one that I do relate to. But there's, I think, a lot of white people, or a lot of people who are living in their privilege, have been ignorant. We've had such heavy blinders on how the rules were not being adhered to for Black people overall. And I feel shame. I mean, that's in my lifetime. I'm sure that I might have been that person who thinking, okay, this is going to happen. And I just wouldn't have thought through it, and or would not have known how to intervene effectively on your behalf or the others. I think personally, I've gotten a lot better about just leaning in and, you know, okay, we're all going to talk about this. Like, mm-hmm. the only way we're going to get through this is everybody has to put their skin, their voice in the game to see what the problem is here so we can come up with some solutions.
That's it directly. Everyone may not be able to relate to that experience specifically, but we all know when a problem seems so massive, you think to yourself, what can I, just trying to live my daily life and be successful and mm-hmm. do the things that are meaningful, what can I do to a problem that has been unaddressed by the creator of the issue? So yet, how can I, an individual citizen, yes. when we've got 330 million other people in this country, make that impact? But as we're finding out, we absolutely can make a difference to the people that are around us and be an example. And so I just appreciate you sharing and putting yourself in there. It's oftentimes people can reflect on people who they knew, but with both you and I being willing to say, hey, here's something that happened to me, or I myself was unintentionally or intentionally not paying total attention to it. And mm-hmm. it's something that didn't necessarily have to happen, or could have used that voice and it would have made a difference. I look at it sometimes in terms of being the person that's willing to call your own friends and loved ones out, which is the most difficult, you know, when someone says something at a dinner table or someone says something on a car ride, you know, most times people just let it pass. And I think we're finding out that collectively, if we're all doing that, who's going to be the one that kind of stops the behavior?
Yeah, I've so many of those type of moments are flashing through my mind.
What I was really interested in is, and I know you spoke a bit in terms of your experience, particularly in folks living in their privilege. Mm. I think both of us have shared in terms of being witness and also, you know, living in this country, just day to day, you know, in different communities and moving through in different eras and interacting with different generations. I think the people that we've been able to touch in our lives, when you think of your great grandparents or your grandparents, what they were connected to, and then down to the generation that's up next, the gap is not that far, but the eras and like the acceptable social norms couldn't be further apart in just one or two lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And what I'm really interested to know what you see in terms of a way forward, a path to reconciliation, and how you believe that reparations indirectly transferring some of that wealth that we talked about can make a difference.
I mean, we talk generally, right? Our goal is to create a more perfect union. That's a broad thing. But I'll tell you a couple of things that I had in mind, because I think that we're creating like a demonstration project. I was thinking like, okay, by 2040, which is 20 years from now, which is like, I think one generation, and you know, that's probably all I have to give to this project, another 20 years. I want the percent of Black Americans who have wealth to transfer to their next generation has increased. And I want to figure out what percent of Black Americans the increase needs to be for it to be meaningful. Absolutely. I'm hoping that we will equalize or like shrink the gap in the amount and types of wealth that whites and Blacks are transferring. Because it's not just about the money to me, but overall, everyone has enough wealth in their life that creates a family safety net. something that I have had, not only a family safety net, but that family investment where the parents can help with the down payments of the house and help pay for college. I want everybody to have that amount of wealth. I want it to extend to everybody. Reparations is going to help me. I mean, I'm 60. I feel very sad about everything I've lost. I want my full humanity. And I think I can only get there through reparations. Because in addition to the money transfer, like I'm super excited about helping to stimulate government action on the broadest national and global scale for reparations, with people having more stakeholders. Like when they're homeowners, they are stakeholders. They are more invested in their community. And then we get this revitalized democracy that we realize democracy is not a maintenance-free effort. And if we don't have stakeholders and we're showing up and talking to each other and coming to common ground, we are going to lose big time. And I think of that from our planet's perspective. Like, we are not going to have environmental sustainability if everybody doesn't want to come to the table. And so reparations, I hope, gets people to the common good. So it's for me.
It's just wonderful to hear it elucidated that way. So many of the efforts that look like they're just for Black people or who have not been silenced about the contributions since the beginning of the country, before it was a country, and kind of being told to forget that and get on with it. And that never having been settled, never having been made right. I mean, even when you go to the Constitution, the amendments that are there seemingly just for Black people, those are the building blocks of democracy for the rest of our society. And so almost, you know, we would prefer that that did not happen. However, you know, considering out of one's great pain, what's good for Black people has always been good for the whole country. And if we can realize that, we, you know, had many times when we were either made to leave or told to leave or given some type of deal to leave, this literally is our country. You know, around the time of the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln met with the learned Black scholars of the day and asked them, hey, like, I can end this now if you guys are willing to go somewhere. And they come back and say, our great grandparents are buried here. We're from here, you know? And to your earlier point about the global reality of this, at the HR 40 get together they'd have every year at the Congressional Black Caucus, since the bill was introduced, you'd have people from the world coming over. A really great scholar, Sir Hillary from Barbados, took this to the House of Lords. Not only was a member elected that owned his family, but also there was a member there elected that owned his wife's family at one point. And so looking how this has been globalized, the need to bring people together. You know, one of the outcomes that I really hope for is that we can realize that someone who does not feel a part of their own democracy right now, I truly believe, will be the person that keeps it together. And if we don't include and encourage them in this process and make them whole on what they've never felt, we will lose the whole experiment. The whole premise that we can do this as people who are totally different in a place together for some reason that has to still exist, in my opinion. I really believe it in many ways that the person who's left out or kept out is going to be the one that saves us. And doing this is good for those who have been without, who have been intentionally targeted, but also for folks who have believed what their privilege is. When they see what that open and that full humanity society is, what you used to have is going to seem so not fulfilling, not relevant.
Yes. And I'm really excited to help with that message, because I don't think that has been a very visible part of the benefits of reparations. So does that kind of get at what you hope reparation generation?
It does, in a moral and financial recognition of the truth. You know, I believe if you have 30, 40 million ancestors of people who were enslaved, not in the pre-Civil War iteration that we get in movies where we're watching these films and it's like, hey, if you can just hold on, you're going to get free. Mm-hmm. We're always, every movie we're dropped into, it's like right in those 10 years before. Mm-hmm. And you know, just kind of think with the movie 12 Years a Slave, that was 1810. And so the underlying dramatic issue is that if you don't get out, not at any time in your lifetime will that war come, will that freedom come. Mm-hmm. But what I really hope is that you don't see it as that romanticized version of freedom, but the initial, you know, people brought here, that rectifying that wrong is incredibly important, the origin of this whole thing. And I think if we can get out of our own way of saying, I know what happened, I know how they felt because I, you know, live here or there, or me looking and saying, it's your particularly your fault. This one person who lives across a border from me, across 8 miles from me, you're the responsible party. If we can get ourselves oriented around what the original happening was, we're going to be able to unlock what we can't even imagine is just around the corner. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can make it in modern terms. We've all left a bad toxic relationship, we've moved on and thought we wouldn't know happiness, thought we wouldn't know anything else existed. And then, wow, you mean you left one office and what was in store for you around the corner was so much greater. And I do truly believe in our country and our society, when we get this right, when we encourage other actors, we can't do this alone. You know, we're a small group. I hope tons of small other groups have pilots that are successful in work to encourage, then it encourages larger scale action from both federal and corporations, right? Who have kind of become entrenched and benefited from this society. And I think that we're closer than a generation, but the commitment of folks who have lived through it is going to really, really determine how we do. Yeah. I'm hopeful.
Oh, I just feel like you said it so beautifully. I appreciate the analogy to toxic relationships. It can be so hard to see them for what they were. And like you say, feeling like you'll never get into a healthier one, or they aren't out there, but they are.
Yeah.
Like, I hope that reparation generation is understood by all the other actors on the stage. And I hope that, you know, our strategy is understood, that it's valued, and it plays one specific effective role in accomplishing the more perfect union.
Well, I'm really glad that we got to learn more about each other today. I know we spend time on calls, but I really do appreciate just learning and being able to share.
Me too.
Look forward to keeping this going and building our relationship too.
I am too, because I will say I have enjoyed every reparation generation meeting, because people are bringing their best efforts for a shared win.
Absolutely.